We're live. So, welcome to this event from So Simple a Beginning, Darwin's 200th birthday. Actually, technically celebrated a week from today, of course, on February 12th, the same day that Abraham Lincoln was born. And this year is also the 150th anniversary of the publication of this book on the origin of species, his magnum opus, or at least the groundbreaking book. We do not have with us one of the three scheduled speakers. I just spoke with him a few moments ago. His plane just landed in San Francisco, flying back from Washington, D.C., where he told me that in his day job business there, he had occasion to visit the Pentagon because his company, I guess, is trying to sell something to those folks. And so he told me that while he was at the Pentagon, he was infusing the space with the energies from the Kabbalistic meditations that he learned from the R.J. Stewart talk that we're going to speaker R.J. Stewart offered in this space back in December. I should note, by the way, that R.J. Stewart will be returning at the end of March for another event. He's incredible, and the meditation is very powerful and wonderful. So Stewart can't be with us tonight, but he's been doing his work nevertheless. So kudos to him. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to begin just to set the tone, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jim for a while. Jim, I guess I should introduce ourselves for those who may not know us. Jim Wilson is the manager of Many Rivers Books and Tea. He and I and Stuart are the three co-founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, which is owned and operated by Tayu Meditation Center. But Jim is not a Tayu practitioner, but what he does and the themes that we'll be talking about tonight are very congruent with the attitudes that Tayu brings to spiritual practice, which is one of the reasons why we're happy to host this talk. And Jim has, I said in the publication notes for this talk that Jim has talked about establishing a Church of Darwin. So I'm going to nominate him for Archbishop or maybe even a higher ecclesiastical office in that institution. Maybe we can all vote on it tonight.
Chief Muckety Muck.
Oh, holy ape. Perhaps. But I wanted to begin the evening by reading the concluding paragraph of On the Origin of Species, which is, I actually read about a year ago in anticipation of this 200th anniversary year for Darwin, some reviews of Darwin's work. And one of the points being made was that Darwin was a wonderful writer, quite the stylist. And this will give you at least a sense of his work. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth. And to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the external conditions of life, and from use and disuse. A ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object of which we are capable of conceiving, namely, the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers. Having been originally breathed into a few forms, or into one. And that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on, according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Take it away.
Isn't that beautiful? That's a wonderful vision of life unfolding. I'm not a scientist and I'm not a biologist. And one of the reasons I wanted to have a night devoted to Darwin, there were quite a few reasons. One is that we're a spiritual bookstore and we're all aware of the contention between Darwin and the history that his theory has created. And so I thought a spiritual bookstore should, create a space for opening that up, to his vision. But the other, another reason I wanted to talk about Darwin is that I think, my personal opinion is that there is no person more influential than Charles Darwin from the 19th century. There were certainly scientists as important, I often think of Mendeleev, for example, and his discovery of the periodic table has had immense influence. But when I say that Darwin is the most influential thinker of that century, it's because the ordinary man in the street has an understanding of evolution that's trickled down, it's permeated our thinking in a way that other scientific theories have not. If you're not a chemist, the periodic table isn't something you sort of carry around in your consciousness. It's really quite astonishing how this theory has permeated our lives. So what I'd like to do is just make a few observations and have a kind of a living room discussion about Darwin. As I said, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a specialist. So these are one individual's hopefully thoughtful comments about Darwin. One of the things that always impressed me about Darwin was his capacity for observation. It's really astonishing. He spent... how long was the voyage of the Beagle? I can't remember.
5 years.
And he spent 5 years gathering data and making observations. That's amazing dedication. And that was just a portion of his observations. He made observations in England before that. And after coming back to England, it was a very long time before he published The Origin of the Species. He was always tinkering with it and adding on to it and putting more information in it. In fact,
he still called it a sketch.
He still
this book is his sketch. This is not the whole thing, according to him.
And the only reason he published it when he did was because another person by the name of Alfred Wallace published a monograph on evolutionary theory, which the theory was identical to Darwin's. That is a theory by natural selection. Even though Wallace's preceded Darwin by a few months, Darwin's is what is read today, and that is because he was so meticulous. Wallace's monograph is a general theory. It doesn't have a lot of examples. It's a good theory. It's a presentation. But I would call Wallace's monograph a sketch. And I think that was one of the reasons that Darwin became so influential. The Origin of Species is packed with examples. Everything from tortoises to finches to...
Honeybees,
worms. He just gave you the whole range of life, You know, and there's something really, his ability to observe and not bring his preconceptions to the observation is something that I still find remarkable. You know, like, he was destined to be a minister. He was brought up in a family, and that was his career. And he had to bracket that whole, the whole weight of that tradition about the flood, Noah's Ark, and that was still a very powerful paradigm at that time. You know, like, and it just wouldn't mesh with the observations he made. I mean, he wasn't the only one thinking. You know, he wasn't isolated. There were a lot of geologists at that time who were expanding the sense of time. But still, it's. I know that I personally find it hard to bracket culturally accepted ideas and views and just look in a sort of bare, attentive way. And that was a remarkable gift that he had, you know, that he was able to do that. And not only do it, but then report, you know, like, on what he actually observed. I think that that's amazing. There's some... I would put that in the category of meditation, you know, that he was doing some kind of meditative observation. You know, like,
I'll have more to say on that later.
Okay. The second comment I wanted to make is, you know, immediately upon the publication of Origin of Species, there was friction arose between religion and Darwin's view of the world. And it's interesting, I just want to touch on that. I mean, there's the in the U.S., the Scopes trial is famous, you know, like, but there were equally famous gatherings in England at the time, you know, like, of very contentious, you know, arguments about it, and it's contentious today. I guess it's, I can't remember the statistics, but there's a very large percentage of people in the United States today do, you know, reject the theory of evolution. You know, like, creationist foundations receive a huge amount of money and, you know, and constantly push their agenda. But what's interesting to me is, if you look, that's not universally true of all spiritual traditions. Not all spiritual traditions have had a problem with Darwin's vision, you know, like, and so it's, I find it instructive to ask why, you know, like, why have some traditions had a big problem with it, and why have other spiritual traditions not had a big problem with it? A good example is Confucianism, Buddhism, Hinduism. You know, like, they have in general not had a problem dealing with Darwin, you know, like, and my tentative conclusion is that it has to do with the role of cosmology in a particular spiritual tradition. That is the structure of the universe. You know, like, and Buddhism, Confucianism, has what I call a weak cosmological commitment. You know, like, when I, if you read the Buddhist discourses, the Buddha had a cosmology. If you read the Confucian Analects, he had a cosmology. He talks about heaven and earth and every now and then. But that's not where their tradition is weighted. That's not that it's not central to their tradition. You know, like, so when Buddhism spread beyond India, for example, it simply adopted the cosmology of the cultures that it went to with very little friction. I mean, it wasn't a big issue. You know, like, so when Buddhism went to China, it adapted and adopted Chinese cosmology. When it went to Japan, it adapted and adopted the Shinto kind of cosmology of Japan. Because once again, that wasn't the central focus of the Buddha's teachings. But in some forms of Western monotheism, cosmology is crucial, you know, like, and it has to do with a certain vision of creation. You know, like, so that if God created the universe at a certain moment in time, you know, like, and created in a certain way and you invest your spiritual tradition in that structure, then if someone challenges that structure, what you're doing is challenging God. Like you're undermining the view of God, and I think that's the connection. You know, like if you reach a certain point, you know, like where you say that particular structure is divine, like then to question that particular arrangement of existence will be undermining your understanding of the divine. Like. And I think that I'm speaking in very general terms, but I think that that's what happened, particularly in medieval Western understandings of what ultimate nature meant. I call this the misplacement of eternity. The nature of eternity was misplaced into a cosmological structure, you know, like, and that isn't really where eternity lies. You know, like the Buddha used to say that the and Hinduism also has this view: the entire cosmos disintegrates, you know, like into an eon of nothingness or. Along, and then through karmic forces, a new eon emerges. So the idea of a cosmos disappearing is not, it's actually part of Indian spirituality. Confucius didn't think it like that. He didn't have much to say about it one way or the other. You know, like, when the Buddha talked about the deathless and the unborn, he specifically said that it was not you couldn't find it in a particular realm of existence because realms of existence are impermanent. You know, like, so that would undermine what I would call placing eternity into a particular cosmological structure. Am I making sense, or is this too abstract? The third comment I wanted to make is just a general comment about Darwin's vision. Darwin's vision is a vision of a mutable universe. You know, so everything's changing. You know, like everything is evolving, and evolving incidentally doesn't necessarily mean improving. It means adjusting to environmental circumstance. You know, like which is an important point. You know, like to make. Because Darwin's vision has been used for political purposes that are at times quite unsavory. You know, social Darwinism in the United States, racist theories were evolved that, you know, appeared that, you know, certain races were more evolved than other races. There's a new book out that addresses this issue called Darwin's Sacred Cause. And Desmond and Moore are historians. And it's their view that one of the things that motivated Darwin in his evolving the theory of evolution was a very strong commitment to the anti-slavery cause. And his belief that if you could determine and prove that all humanity descended from a single source, that would undermine the view that certain people were inherently inferior along racial grounds to others. You know, like... And he did believe that. He did believe that that would actually be a consequence of evolutionary theory. You know, like, so it hasn't always been used that way. In fact, often it has not been used that way. But in a sense, Darwin's vision is that all creatures are equally evolved at the moment. You know, because they've all adjusted. You know, they're all here. Due to a long chain of causes, you know, like, and so in at least my understanding of Darwin's theory and view of existence is that it actually levels things, you know, like it creates a more level field rather than hierarchic view of existence. If you take the Neoplatonic point of view, which permeated Western thought for a long time, creatures are arranged in a chain of being such that certain creatures are much closer to the ultimate nature, like angels, for example. And then you have these concentric rings. You know, and human beings aren't as close as angels, but they're much closer than animals, insects, you know, worms, plants, rocks. You know, like it gets farther and farther away. But Darwin's vision seriously undermines that kind of concentric circle view. And from an evolutionary perspective, the trees in Armstrong Woods are as evolved as you and I who are sitting here. I think one of the reasons that Darwin rubs a lot of people the wrong way, or people get itchy about it, is science has had a tendency to displace human beings from the center of existence. You know, like, so Galileo and Copernicus displaced the Earth, you know, from the center of the solar system. And as astronomy went on, I mean, you know, not even our galaxy was the center of it. You know, like, we're an ordinary galaxy sort of on the fringe, and, you know, like, and it's difficult, I think, for us to sort of put into our minds what it must have meant to people who thought of their planet and their residence as, you know, the center around which everything revolved, you know, like, and to have that undermined. It must have been quite a shock, you know, like. But I think that Darwin does a similar thing to the place human beings occupy in the web of life. You know, like, human beings are simply one more creature who has appeared according to the laws that he refers to, you know, like
natural selection.
Natural selection, you know, like, and one day, you know, like, other creatures will appear, and maybe will be around for hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years, but. Creatures appear and they pass away, and if you think of human beings as having like as being extraordinarily unique in the cosmos, or having like some special function in the cosmos, then Darwin's theory raises the question of, well, you know, is that really true? You know, aren't we really, in a very basic sense, don't we share the same nature as trees and birds in the sky and the other creatures on this earth? You know, like, I actually like that consequence of Darwin's theory, but I can understand why some people find that uncomfortable. You know, like, and again, according to the view of certain religious traditions, human beings were created especially uniquely, you know, and endowed with unique features that make them particularly special or particularly spiritual or particularly, you know, exalted. You know, like, it's being, you know, Darwin's view sort of questions that and says, well, maybe we're just one part of a community of life that has a vast expanse both in space and time.
Jim, what are the implications of that view on how this form of life should treat the others? Because when I look at thinking about your earlier comment about, you know, life forms come into existence and out of existence, and it seems like there's a lot of competition as well as a lot of cooperation, but where does morality enter?
That's a very good question. You know, like, I'm glad you brought up the cooperation point. If I have one hesitancy about Darwin, it's that cooperation is an evolutionary mechanism. That is to say, it's a mechanism that allows creatures to reproduce And you know, it's a selective mechanism that allows creatures to a species to continue to be present. I ordered, but it didn't arrive. Peter Kropotkin wrote a book called
Mutual Aid.
Mutual Aid, you know, like, and the subtitle is A Factor in Evolution, you know, like, in which he presents the argument that the ability of creatures to cooperate with each other is a factor in selecting them, in allowing them to reproduce and to continue, you know, like, and his view was that, so it's not only a battle, you know, like for limited resources, and the winner who gets propelled into the next generation. It's also those creatures who have learned social skills, you know, like are an evolutionary factor. I don't think Darwin would disagree with that. The two views are not contradictory.
Is this interspecies cooperation?
It can be. There are examples of interspecies cooperation. In fact, there are many in nature.
Well, aside from, I guess, from symbiotic kind of things, which I don't know how, whether that's considered active cooperation or something else.
Well, let me propose several examples, and I have a background in archaeology, and in fact one of the areas that was, you know, my area of specialty was the development of farming, early farming, and so that means that people have been looking at how domestic species, both plant and animal, have changed from their wild ancestors as they were first found by human beings living wherever they happened to be exploiting those resources. So from a number of points of view, you could say that cattle have evolved us to expand their range vastly over the globe, have evolved us to serve their ends and needs.
It's actually cats.
Don't forget the barley. But it's the plants and animals, and so in fact some of the more interesting and more sophisticated, less simplistic views of the evolution of the practice of domestication suggest that in fact people were very avid observers of nature without necessarily having any, but they had no resources to imagine the evolution through time and installation of different or instilling of different characteristics in successive generations so as to actually change the properties and characters of species. But the act of choosing to harvest, you know, species at a different time has consequences. And the other point that I'll make in regard to this is some very recent research that I just happened to read a few weeks ago, making the point that in nature, for the most part, predation by one species on another, wolves to caribou, for example, the pattern is that the old, the weak, the ill, are the members of that species who survive, and the strong, mature, sexually reproductive members of the species are the ones that are not, for the most part, killed by the wolves. But humans have a tendency to do exactly the opposite. So, for example, with species of fish and other marine species that we have been overexploiting lately, you get a pattern where the size of those creatures is declining. In other words, the successive generations tend to be smaller, and sexual reproduction, the onset of sexual reproduction for those species is earlier. So we are acting without intending to, as selective factors changing the characteristics of those species over time. And you can call that mutual in a lot of ways. It is a mutual relationship, and it's complex. But one of the things that Darwin does for us is give us some principles by which we can understand these mutual effects and consequences.
How is that mutual? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not following. How is that mutual? How the fish?
The fish are because we are treating them in a certain fashion. They, in order to survive, have to respond by, in other words, the fish that are naturally able to reproduce earlier are the ones that are most successful at reproducing. So that means that we end up having smaller and smaller fish to eat over time. The California Indians had this effect on populations of abalone thousands of years in the past. There are lots of archaeological evidence to suggest that. So and you know, there's lots of evidence of that sort of activity on lots of islands in the Pacific. In fact, the one that you come from, New Zealand, there's examples of human predation of species which either changes the characteristics of those species or leads them to extinction, such that has led them to extinction prior to the appearance of Europeans, even prior to the experience to the introduction of European populations to those islands.
Isn't there some reciprocity?
Asking the question about how that would change humans.
It changes humans because humans can't eat that stuff anymore.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And so it looks like in the far distant past, humans subsisted on large prey. Mm-hmm. Over time, in a small island or even on the California coast, humans have to go from very large, easy to secure food to more and more difficult to secure food, smaller packets of food, as the archaeologists would talk about. So that's what I mean by it's not mutual in the sense of conscious. That's what I'm trying to point out here. If you don't want to have to think about it in terms of a conscious intention on the part of clams to make us do something different. Because we're not doing something consciously to make the clams different. And yet, there is this effect produced in both directions. So that you get, at some periods of time, the Mesolithic populations in Europe, for instance, that I studied, the last period of hunter-gatherers, you get human populations where males and females are more nearly equal in size physically than any other time or place that we know of in human evolution. Okay. Subsequent human populations become more dimorphic, more different. Male and female populations become more different in size. Okay. And that's because their food source has changed. That's what I mean by mutual. I don't mean, and expressly don't mean, the clams telling us what to do, the cows telling us what to do. But that's the beauty of this set of principles that he's pointing out to us. The beauty of this set of principles is that we can understand how we affect each other without intending to. So, Christian had his hand up first. There's a lot of hand up, but Christian was first here.
I think it's important to keep in mind that evolution not only affects our physical nature, our size, our strength, our color, what have you, but it affects our behavioral nature. So as the California Indians exploited the abalone and there was less and less abalone and you were getting less protein and meat back from the abalone, you started altering your behavior to exploit other animals, and so that you could say that the abalone affected and altered the way that the California Indian behaved in relationship to the fact that the abalone itself had diminished in size.
Exactly. Thank you. That's nicely put.
I have a little story to share about cross-species relationships are, to me, really interesting. When I was a kid, there was an example of in Life magazine, this guy caught it on by accident. What happened was a crocodile attacked an antelope on the shore, and a hippopotamus came pounding down the beach, you know, like, and stomped on the crocodile. You know, like,
wow.
And then the hippopotamus pushed the wounded antelope up the bank, you know, like, out of reach of the crocodile. You know, like, so, I mean, to me, that's very interesting. You know, like, I mean, what, you know, like, what was, I mean, I can understand hippopotami not liking crocodiles. I mean, who does? but that kind of cross-species assistance or cooperation or that kind of thing, it actually happens much more often than we tend to think. I mean, of course, species interact with themselves, most of the time. I mean, that's just natural. You know, like, but these other examples occur very very frequently as well. No one could interview the hippopotamus to say, you know, like, why did you do that? You know, like, that sort of thing. But and that was very dramatic. But Kropotkin's book, I'm sorry, I don't have it here, has many similar examples that are much less spectacular, much more ordinary.
Laura had her hand up there just before you. But
oh, it was just an observation about the word mutual, which is what I hear you describing about us dealing with the fish and then what it affects us, and then we do different things, is the word feels like repercussion rather than mutual.
Okay.
Often mutual implies a simultaneous occurrence. That when I tap his arm moves, and you know, and he taps me back, and it's kind of closer.
Mm-hmm.
But this one takes time. At first, we keep eating the fish, and they start getting smaller and smaller. And then, because the fish are now smaller and smaller, we change our diet.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like if mutual implies a different timing as opposed to the sequencing of effects.
I understand that your point, and I guess my response would be that it's a matter of scale. I agree with you on that. But I think it's actually that one of the things that Darwin helps us understand is looking at it from a vastly deeper time scale than we're used to doing helps us understand things, phenomena that are important to us, to the world around us, in ways that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do. The stuff about how domesticated species are created and change the people that create them or their descendants, more precisely, and vice versa, is, I think, the kind of time scale that's obvious to think about in this regard. So you can look at it at a different depending on the specific question, you can look at it at a more narrow time scale or a larger time scale as appropriate. But I agree with you that just one time scale is inappropriate. Mary.
There was something in the newspaper that recently
about the fisheries being in trouble, and they said if you want to correct it, instead of throwing back the small fish, you better throw back the big fish.
That's right.
That's just what you're talking about.
That's
right,
exactly
now,
right.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. And also the nets that take the big ones and let the little ones go through. Mm-hmm. So we're just propagating.
There's, and those are not intended. That no, those are not even intended consequences.
But they say we better start thinking about
right.
it.
Right.
You know, and stop selecting.
Right.
And keeping only the big ones.
That's
know,
right. I mean, that's why, for example, tuna populations are crashing in the Mediterranean and in the Atlantic and so forth.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that'll directly affect the pocketbooks of people in this room in the near future, probably.
And the lifestyles.
So, what's that?
And the lifestyles. We've become too efficient.
That's right.
We're running out
that's,
of sources.
That's right. So, and in fact, efficiency... You know, efficiency and exploitation of a resource is something that has just the effects we were talking about before. The, you know, when as the California Indians got more and more efficient at getting those delicious abalone, that changed the ecology of the coast, changed them, and those changes further changed the ecology of the coast and led them to do.
So, did they move
things.
Offshore farther, the abalone?
Well, I don't want to get into the specifics of it. It's a complicated issue, but it's an interesting issue. We can talk about it another time. Okay, go ahead.
It brings in more scavenger species, so like sea urchins and things like that, so we're left with a change in the world dynamic.
There's all kinds of things happening right now because of the ease of transport and travel that we have instituted for ourselves. We have sudden, you know, sudden oak death syndrome here. We have a host of other, there's the introduction of species endemic to one area that have totally apparently destructive consequences in new ecological contexts. You know.
There's been a proposal made, I can't remember the scientific body, scientists are arguing that we have entered the Anthropocene, like so.
Right.
Period. You know, like in the sense that human beings have become so pervasive and their effects have become so predominant that it will actually leave a change in the geological record. I guess it would be a geological society that would make this proposal. That will be observed in the future in terms of like sediment on the ocean floor and that sort of thing.
No. Absolutely.
I wanted to just quickly give one example of mutual interaction that we had a book in here. I sold it, so I don't have it out here right now, about the evolution of dogs. You know, like and the idea is that. A long time ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago, some juvenile wolves attached themselves to human beings. And in terms of evolutionary strategy, wolves have had a tough time. Their population is, you know, like difficult. You know, like as an evolutionary strategy, attaching themselves to human beings was very successful. You know, I mean, speaking strictly, you know, like along Darwinian lines. It really worked. You know, like there's pound for pound, there's a lot more dogs around than there are wolves.
And
you know, like,
fed.
And they're fed, and they're taken care of, and they're.
We shoot wolves, and we feed dogs.
Right, we shoot wolves, we feed dogs. You know, we have a Westminster Kennel Club, but we don't have a Westminster Wolf Show. And in that early interaction, human beings benefit from having. Canines around in many ways, you know, like early on it was, you know, for hunting and guarding and all that sort of thing, but there are many psychological benefits as well, you know, like so the book was talking was a book length discussion of this kind of mutuality, but again it was over a long period of time,
you know. So I want to bring the discussion around to back a little bit to religion or spiritual practice, because I think that's an interesting aspect of this. My own perspective is that, you know, I have this archaeological, anthropological, scientific training, and am well steeped in that arena, and have had a lot of fun with all that. But I also have this, which actually preceded the beginning of which preceded the anthropological archaeological training, and now has in a sense succeeded it, since I'm not really doing all that much academically at the moment. And that's my spiritual training, my meditative spiritual training. And the point that Jim was making earlier, which is cogent for me, is this point about Darwin the observer. Darwin, the clear-eyed observer of nature. And to me, that is the key characteristic of a meditation practice, of any genuine, and this is a broader claim which I would have to substantiate, and maybe I will, depending on how the discussion goes, that it is a characteristic of any genuine religious endeavor. Because to me, the religious impulse is one of exploration, of opening your consciousness ever more to the world around you. In any aspect. Doesn't have to be only strictly materialist, which is why I'm not still in academia, I guess. But that impulse to treasure and cultivate and deepen and intensify observation, and to make that the sine qua non of existence is exactly what the religious impulse is about, in my view, and certainly in terms of my Tayu tradition. But this is a different view than many religious practitioners would agree with. So it's certainly controversial, but I'm just going to throw it out there and see what kind of discussion we can get. I can already see some expressions that we might get some discussion here. That in fact that is the core of the genuine religious impulse, the genuine spiritual practice. It is to be open to the universe. It is to observe impartially as much as possible. With love, I think just that passage I read earlier demonstrates that Darwin loved the act of observation. How could he not have? This five-year voyage, these years preceding that and years succeeding that, of careful, meticulous observation and diagrams. I mean, you really have to look at some of these books that we have over here after the talk, by the way. There's some beautiful, beautiful stuff in these books. I mean, you can see the cover from here, some of the incredible stuff that people were doing in the 19th century by way of trying to observe nature with clarity. Well, from my view, and admittedly it's controversial, all of nature is there to be observed. And there's no part of it that we can bracket off and say this only is spiritual. That's my view. There's some discussion I was expecting. Laura?
Well, actually, I think that the only word I would object to, the only part of what you said is when you said that it's the sine qua non, because I believe that observation of reality is an essential part of any spiritual path and practice. However, I would say the sine qua non, which is not a word I would say in the first place, but I would just say that.
You just did.
I would say the sine qua non of the spiritual religious impulse is love. And that observation may be used as a means to it. But for me to put observation above the expression of love puts the head before the heart.
Okay, got that. See, my view is that without observation, love is often impossible, because what happens in the way that our consciousness works is that the ego throws up obstacles that we can't see, and it's only through observation, both of the object of love and the obstacles to the observation of that object, that we can actually practice love. There's a wonderful book in the store by Jacob Needleman, and what is the name of it? Amba, help me out here. No. It's the one where he's talking about Christianity, lost Christianity, and his argument there is that the Christian impulse to love your neighbor as yourself, or not impulse, but injunction, is a wonderful thing, is true and accurate, and contains the whole of the law. But there needs to be a middle step between recognizing that and practicing it. And in this, and I can agree with you to the extent here, I think, of saying that in a sense, in terms of the discussion we're having here tonight, observation would be that middle step. Observation is the opening of the heart, actually, in my view.
I don't have any problem with that. It's just that when you talk about the religious and spiritual impulse and goals, it's like, I don't want to worship the means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the end that's of essence. And if I practice observation and then hit my neighbor again,
that's not
that idea. It's like, what's the point? It's mm-hmm. like, if you can do all the observation in the world, but the measure of it is the end result.
Hmm.
Okay. So it's about where you put your emphasis.
Okay, I think we had a question.
Yeah. Well, I'd say that they come together. In fact, it all comes together when you take on the practice of, and then this isn't for everyone, but you take on the practice of looking at the world, looking at the history of this planet, the evolutionary history, and recognizing that what has happened is the human and animal forms have evolved a consciousness that is now present in physical form. And to look at it and wonder, how is this field of awareness being sustained within this physical body? And I wrote a book on the topic.
Thank you. Michael.
And point of reference, I think ultimately that love and an observation are the same thing. Which we're looking for that point of reference from which we can most efficiently perceive, see the wholeness of things. And when we're observing from one point of reference, something inside seems to fall short, and we're not quite left as whole with ourselves as we'd like to be. And so we find, hey, I'm still processing. I'm still churning inside somehow. And we want to move past that place of churning. So it's almost like an evolution of the observer, the evolution of observation towards love. Finding at last that works the best, that point of reference.
I got that. In our Tayu tradition, in fact, the specifics of how we accomplish impartial observation precisely is meant to focus attention upon the operation of the organism and anything else going on that we are can potentially be aware of in consciousness. So in fact, that's the creation of the context within which love can flourish, I guess I would say. So thank you. James.
Excuse my ignorance, but was he, did he sort of deny an abstract intelligence, like an abstract universal intelligence, or whatever you want to call it, was he, did he deny, it sounds like in that last paragraph that he was sort of paying homage to it, but I was always under the impression that he was pretty reductionist, mechanist sort of.
Oh, actually, that's a good question. Jim, maybe you
I don't think he addressed that much. I'm not aware of him writing anything particularly pertaining to that issue. But that's one of the things I mentioned about Darwin and religion in the West, and certainly at Darwin's time, the dominant religious tradition was heavily invested in a particular story about the cosmos.
Right.
You know, like, and he was aware that the evolutionary theory undermined that story. You know, he couldn't not be aware of it. You know, like,
and from what I understand, he specifically did not take a public position on this point because, number one, he was quite comfortable with his own personal life and did not want that comfort challenged. But number two, I think it's also more creditably to him, you could ascribe a motive of skillful means in a Buddhist sense. That is to say, if you address that issue in the context that he was writing, which followers and some of the supporters of his ideas certainly did. I mean, these people took up banners and were extraordinarily strong proponents of demolishing some of the previous notions. But Darwin himself was meticulous about not going there, about not directly challenging this principle. And instead, I think you can take just from that paragraph that I read the clarity that he was to talk about universal laws could imply a resonance with a creator God, but need not go there. It's actually a very skillful, you know, balancing act, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on that a good example of what Rob was referring to is that shortly after The Origin of Species was published, there was a conference held where proponents and opponents of Darwin's thesis came together. It was extremely intense. Huxley was his big defender at the time. Huxley was, what, maybe 20 years younger than Darwin? Maybe 30 years younger, I can't remember. But and Darwin was invited to that first conference and all subsequent conferences, and he always said that he appreciated being invited, but he declined. You know, like he would decline for reasons of health or because he had a previous commitment, but he always declined to engage in those public acrimonious debates. And I think his view was, this is how I see the universe working. This is why I think the universe works that way. And that, you know, debate and those kinds of things don't really, I think he felt it didn't really further his vision of existence. You know, Darwin's vision, it is amazing. It's gone way beyond biology. There are theories of physics now which talk about the cosmos evolving. What's the plural of cosmos?
Cosmoses.
Yeah, like that there are parallel universes and they're selected according to the configurations of the basic laws. And I mean, it's really quite astonishing how this vision has spread to every branch of science and every arena of human thought. And I think that my personal view of Darwin was that he was naturally very reticent, and I wanted to return to this thing about observation. You know, the impression I get of him was that he wanted to be a vehicle to allow the universe to speak. You know, there's a wonderful passage in Dogen's Genjo Koan, where Dogen says, to bring the mind to the 10,000 things is delusion. No, to bring yourself to the 10,000 things is delusion. To be actualized by the 10,000 things is enlightenment. You know, like, and what I understand Dogen to mean by that is that if you bring your preconceptions, if you bring your, you know, your thought patterns and your expectations and your habit forces, you know, to the world, you, in a very real way, you won't see the world. Like, I mean, I've done that.
you'll see your
habits and expectations. You know, like, if you allow the world to actualize you, then everything becomes very clear. You know, what you should do next. You know, how things are operating. And somehow, and this is really interesting to me, somehow Darwin was able to do the second. You know, like, he was able to let the universe appear to him, you know, like, and to drop his expectations. It's really quite amazing to me. You know, I mean, I have a great admiration for him, obviously, you know, like, as an exemplar of how to live in the world, actually. You know, like, to me, Darwin is an admirable man. You know, like...
I want to even expand further on that point, but just briefly, because I actually think that skillful means, as the Buddhists say, is actually a characteristic of the genuine scientific impulse that is actually congruent with the religious or spiritual impulse, as I was outlining it earlier. And that is to say that a scientist observes and creates theories to account for how nature has accommodated itself to itself. But if new evidence arises, new observations are made that invalidate that previous theory, the true scientific impulse is to drop that, just like that. And you go with something, you search for something new, or you can simply be present with the observation itself. I think that's what Darwin had an extraordinary ability to do. I think I would say that that's the, or at least one way to formulate that admirable quality that Jim's referring to. And that's a very unusual thing. People get very attached, and so many of Darwin's followers and the people who formulated themselves as the antagonists of his view have had extremely rigid ideas that they have held on to and have refused to relinquish despite all the evidence you could ever want that those views needed a little adjustment, at least. So that impulse of holding views lightly sounds very Buddhist, kind of, doesn't it? That impulse is at the heart of real science.
He was a Buddhist in the previous.
There we go. That is the characteristic of real science, as well as the great religious practitioner as well.
We have time for a few more questions. So I think Christian was next, and then we'll take David's.
Well, what you're saying here, Rob, is actually a fundamental principle of Buddhism, of find out for yourself. And an interesting aspect of something I recently heard about the Dalai Lama, he was talking about his passionate interest in science. Mm-hmm. And he was saying of the observation of the world, and that if you see the world as it is and Buddhism doesn't agree with it, then Buddhism has to change.
Right.
And that's very much like what you're just saying right now.
Exactly.
And as a scientist, that's exactly what we're supposed to do.
Right.
When we see that what we are experiencing is contrary to what we have been believing, we have to drop it at that point and move on.
We'll come back.
Well, Darwin was very fortunate also in that the theory he came up with was true. It was also very simple and understandable to anyone with an open mind. And it actually conformed to so much reality that he didn't have to argue the case. I think he felt comfortable in just placing it out there and hoping, you know, the storm wasn't too violent and the change that was going to happen. You know.
Thank you. I think we should go back to James here. He looked like he had to say something.
Just what you're saying there, sir. Just see, the monotheists, they start foaming at the mouth when they talk about Darwin, you know. But it seemed to me, at least from what you read there, that he was quite cool with, you know, vitalism or some sort of abstract, immaterial something. Right.
Mm-hmm. Or he was not. He was. He didn't have to commit either way to some of these other things.
But it wouldn't be. That wouldn't really come across as too offensive to a spiritual person.
No.
But certainly to a person that had a, you know, a bloke in the sky that had invented everything. I'd never read Darwin, but that's nothing like what I had.
Got that.
He seemed to have reverence for. Mm-hmm. For these things that, and just with regards to this gentleman's point, as wonderful as science is, there is so much that our educated intellect can't possibly explain.
I get that, but and that's the point where I love your word reverence here, because that actually ties into and can tie into the point about observation I was making before. Observation links to or generates or opens to love when we have reverence for that which we observe, whether it's internal or external. So that was his gift. He had this incredible reverence for life, and that was an amazing thing. Daniel.
Jim brought up the point right in the beginning that Darwin has these huge far-reaching effects in our culture, and everybody kind of understands evolution to a certain degree and that sort of thing, but it seems like a lot of people think that it implies a very mechanical kind of materialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of. Yeah.
And this is the point that he's demonstrating too. He's like, he didn't know that Darwin was kind of like cool with God.
Or not. I don't know if agnostic is a fair word to use. I don't know if he would have agreed with that, but almost.
Not cool
kind
with God,
of
but cool with the possibility of something.
Cool with the possibility of God.
I just want to go back here to it. It depends on how you frame the notion of a creator.
Yeah.
It depends on how the heritage of the West at the time of Darwin had framed, you know, what it meant to be the creator in a very specific way, and the result was this tension. But there are many spiritual traditions that do not frame the ultimate
strains of internal to Christianity that do not as well.
This gentleman hasn't said anything yet, so let's let him say something.
It seems like there's a little bit of Cartesian energy pulling between observation and love, and to me the real blending is that true observation is love.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not, you don't have a goal. You're not trying to
create an effect in that which you observe.
Yeah, you're just, the reverence is part of the act of love and observation together. They're not separated.
I fully agree.
I think what that last paragraph said clearly to me.
Mm-hmm. Thank
Isn't
you.
Isn't it a beautiful paragraph?
Yeah, it really is.
I'm remembering something also from the paragraph that struck me as just being a little bit off from the way I think about things. And I think it was the way he phrased the action of the laws, as if the laws were a causative thing rather than a framework within which an animating life form or life force took place. Do you
I'm sorry, I was distracted for a moment there.
It was in that last paragraph mm-hmm. you read, but I think that that might be where people can infer a reductionistic, mechanistic kind of world because of the way he phrased it when he spoke of the action of the laws.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed as if, when I heard it, it sounded as if the laws were an active force.
Mm-hmm.
Like gravity.
No, not like gravity, like you.
Ah, or maybe, I think this is actually a point where the many misinterpretations of Darwin that have arisen, some of which Jim alluded to, can come from. And we've even spoken about it here tonight. It's not a matter of conscious intention. The action of these laws is not a matter of conscious intention. The problem in English is when we use the word evolution, there is a whole constellation of ideas that comes associated with that word. And many of those ideas imply, to a greater or lesser extent, this notion of conscious intention. And his point, I think, is that, in fact, it's not conscious intention. These creatures and these factors that select to the success of reproduction into the next generation, changing the characteristics of the succeeding generations, that these are not effects that are created intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, people have misinterpreted this, as being precisely what's being talked about. So when, in the 19th century, Darwin's detractors talked about, well, I'm not born. He might have been descended from apes, but not me. There's an element of that coming in there. It's actually very hard to look at the world without imputing conscious intention to the factors that we see around us. In many cases, you can talk. That's at the level of mechanical objects. It's at the level of the fly that's buzzing around in the air, and it's even at the level of much of the actions that people do. Much of it's just, mechanical habits that we've created and that are set in motion by external factors arising that trigger them. So this is my view here. So that takes away a lot of this overlay of conscious intentionality behind what's been going on, and a lot of that it might well come from this idea of a creator God that had these certain intentions to create human beings so that they became good Englishmen in the 19th century or whatever. Christian.
Well, the existence and evolution has an apparent, I emphasize apparent, direction. There was possibly nothing, then there was something, then there was life, now there's consciousness, and it's as an apparent direction of increasing complexity. And that, I do think that is what's happening. And there are those who would say, well, that's something is driving it towards a goal, perhaps, that something is creating it to operate in this way. But fundamentally, to me, evolution would be a very complicated process of unintended consequences. And these things that have come about through a very complicated happenstance process, and it is not
Mechanistic is something where you can predict what the outcome is going to be. I don't think you can predict what the outcome of the evolutionary process is, except to state that it's probably going to become more complex.
Thank you. Let me offer you an image. Maybe we should end with that image. This is an image that starts with. You've all seen, I'm sure, in school, the evolutionary trees that describe, you know, Australopithecus and Homo erectus and Neanderthal, and these things will change, of course, over time. But the main image I want to see is this branch, the trees. It's the images of a tree branching outward. Okay, so extend that into three dimensions. So that you have something, a root, at the beginning, at the center, I should say, of a sphere. And within that sphere, you have all these branches larger in the center and ever finer as they extend to the periphery of this sphere. I actually think that's a useful image to understand the action of natural selection on the evolution of life on this planet. All life, as far as we know, there's maybe a few exceptions that some around sea vents or something like that, or maybe deep in soils. There's been very cool things I've just seen recently reported. But anyway, let's assume that it's all from one origin on this planet, which may be from a cometary matter or something like that, interstellar matter, seeding us. I don't know. Nobody knows yet. But one origin and this vast expansion. Now, today, everything that exists is only on the periphery. The center is just the evolutionary tracks that come together to that center point. Okay? So all life is on the periphery. And the factors that influence and govern natural selection are acting differently on different parts of that periphery, because that periphery includes environments, you know, in Antarctica, in the Amazon jungle, etc. It involves environments like this room and the human-made environment that we have created. This is not excluded from that, nor are our minds excluded from that. In fact, one way to describe the shape of the human cortex is of essentially a thin sheet of film, one layer of neurons thick, that's folded very, very, in three dimensions, very, very complexly. Sort of a recapitulation of this same image that I'm offering for you. So that's the kind of extraordinary view, that vital, beautiful, complex, yet elegant and simple view that Darwin has given us. And I'm so grateful, and I'm very grateful for you all having come here tonight. I'm grateful for Jim's wonderful insights. I think we should definitely make him the Holy Father of Darwinism.
I just have to close with, I was one time really irritated by the latest wave in courts of, you know, creationism, and I thought of starting a Church of Darwin where the Origin of Species would be the holy book, and you know, we would read like that last paragraph as some sort of chanted passage, you know, like it. So that's where that whole idea came from. But really, you know, it's if it's a contest, Darwin's going to win, you know, like, because his observation was so clear. And I just wanted to take time here at Many Rivers to pay homage to Darwin and for all that he's really, you know, done for humanity. He's expanded all of our understanding of existence so immensely that I'm very grateful that he did that for us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Many Rivers Books and Tea has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, generous.